Well, it's time for our second episode devoted to Colonial Williamsburg, one of my favorite places on the planet. Those of you who listened to the first one will recall that we spent pretty much the full hour talking to my buddy Cash Earhart, who gave us background on Williamsburg and the creation of Colonial Williamsburg in the 20th century. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, if you missed our broadcast, you can go to iTunes or to our podcast site and listen to it. But even if you haven't, here, let me bring you up to speed. Today, we're going to talk to several people, two of them named Bill, one of them named Lisa, another named Francis, and we're going to talk about a variety of the outreach and educational efforts that are centered in Colonial Williamsburg today. And you are going to find that there is some real innovation going on there. It's not all about 1774. So stick around. It's your weekly constitutional, and it's all about Colonial Williamsburg.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
This is the second of three episodes devoted to Colonial Williamsburg, and it's kind of hard for me to figure out where to start because, you see, I spoke to several people about the fantastic educational programs at Williamsburg, and a couple of them were named Bill. So they seem to have the majority, so I'll start with a Bill, and maybe I'll end with a Bill. And I'm just going to toss a coin here. Okay, Bill Weldon will be up first. Now, Bill Weldon is a guy I met some time ago when I did an electronic field trip with Colonial Williamsburg on the balance of powers. And he was actually there portraying a character you may be familiar with, Thaddeus Stevens, one of the leaders of the so-called Radical Republicans around the time of the Civil War. And he did a fantastic job. I really enjoyed seeing him in that and speaking to him then. I didn't realize then what I know now, and that is that Bill has advanced at Williamsburg, and he is now the director of creative development for the Revolutionary City. He does all sorts of work creating and supervising special programs in the historic area, partnership program with other groups like the Chautauqua Institution. And let's just let Bill tell you about it.
I am Bill Weldon, and my title is Creative Director for the Revolutionary City at Colonial Williamsburg.
It's a heck of a title.
A heck of a title, yeah. And is both broad enough and vague enough that gives me the opportunity to work on a lot of different projects and get involved in just about all the aspects of how we interpret history at Colonial Williamsburg.
How does one get a job like that? How did you come to this?
Well, one invests a lot of time working in just about every different area of the historic area programs, or what we now call the Revolutionary City. But I actually came to Colonial Williamsburg as a colonial carpenter. I started here as one of the historic trades carpenters, woodworkers involved in reconstructing buildings in the historic area. But my background was in theater.
Okay.
And I studied theater in college. And performing has always been my first love. And so after a few years of working in the carpentry trade and really learning interpretation, doing that, then I transferred over into the character interpretation area and worked as a character, and then began developing programs for different characters, and then began staging and directing a lot of the Revolutionary City scenes and reenactments that we offer folks.
You've mentioned a couple things. You mentioned acting, and then you mentioned interpretation. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some difference there, but I don't know exactly what that is.
Well, the way I define it is acting is one interpretive technique. I see all interpretation as performance, whether you're speaking in the third person, whether you're leading a tour through either the Governor's Palace or the Capitol building or any of the other exhibition sites or historic buildings, or you're portraying Patrick Henry or Thomas Jefferson or an enslaved character named Jacob or Aggie. It's all interpretation. It's just a matter of applying different techniques, different performance techniques to the job that you have.
That's a great definition, Bill, because, you know, I teach law students how to be lawyers. And some of the classes are advocacy classes, and we actually teach them how to go into court and actually convince people of something. And, of course, they're scared to death. And, you know, they don't think of themselves as lawyers. And I said, well, you know, it's pretend you're a lawyer. You know, act like a lawyer. And then if you act like a lawyer, then eventually you will become a lawyer. But you're always going to be having a certain persona in the courtroom that's different than the persona you have back home with your family or with your girlfriend or whatever. And I think is that what you're driving at?
That's precisely what I'm driving at. Any kind of public presentation is a performance of a sort. I know for the few occasions where I've been in courtrooms, any trial lawyer is a performer to some degree.
Oh, yes.
And performance techniques and performance values apply to that, just as they apply to any kind of interpretation, presentation of any kind that occurs in a historic site. So that's broadly how I define interpretation, and then just different techniques applied to particular kinds of presentations.
Right, and I guess even your carpentry work, at least if you were demonstrating it, would be another form of interpretation.
One of the best breaks I've ever had in my career was coming here to work as a historic trades carpenter under a gentleman named Roy Underhill, who was the first master housewright or master carpenter at Colonial Williamsburg. But even as skilled as he was as a woodworker, his greater skill was in communicating and interpreting. And he was a showman. and he was a great mentor in that respect. And his philosophy was, we're not here to tell people things. We're here to stimulate them to think about things. And we're here to provoke them to involve themselves in what we're doing. So any kind of technique that you use or approach you use needs to have that goal in mind.
I think it does. He sounds like a great mentor.
Oh, he was. It was probably the most fortunate thing that could have occurred to me in my career.
That's marvelous. We all need our breaks. I'm glad you got that one.
You bet. Yeah.
I have seen it from the other side. Of course, I've been to Colonial Williamsburg many times over the years, and it worked for me. I mean, it just hooked me from the moment I saw these people who were actually acting as if they were stepping out of the late 18th century. I wanted to be one of them, and it's just a wonderful thing. This reminds me, we're getting a little far afield here, but as you might guess, I'm a big history buff.
Yep.
One of my favorite ways to really understand history is not to read history books, it's to read historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Well done historical fiction, which is based in fact, and obviously there has to be a certain amount of artistic license, but that's where you feel it in your bones. It's one thing to, you know, read, for example, that there was a Holocaust and people died. It's another thing to get to know characters and read about those characters, and then all of a sudden they get caught up in this terrible thing. And all of a sudden you find yourself thinking, oh my gosh, now I understand what it must have been like for those people. And in much much happier sense, that's true here too. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, there was an American Revolution. It's another thing to actually have people telling you why they're feeling revolutionary.
Well, and I think this goes back to that whole question of provocation and what we are about. And by provocation, what I mean is just doing performances, doing presentations that involves people and that actually helps to get the story under their skin, to just feel so caught up in that story that they empathize with, they sympathize
with those
characters, that they can see themselves in the middle of that story. One of the newer initiatives that we've undertaken the past few years is this alternate reality game called RevQuest.
RevQuest.
RevQuest, Save the Revolution. That's the umbrella name that we use for these different games that we have developed, and we're about to launch the fourth game.
These are online games?
It's an online, on-site, online series of games. So ideally, the experience begins online. You find the game online, and you receive really background to the story, the narrative of the game that you'll pursue if you come to Colonial Williamsburg and you play the on-site game. And then each game has a post-visit online extension.
Oh, that is so cool. So some 14-year-old kid finds RevQuest online.
Yeah.
gets caught up in the story, and then ideally, you know, pesters mom and dad until they take him to Colonial Williamsburg, and then picks up where they left off, actually interacts with people here, and then at the end of that, they get to go home, and there's a follow-up online.
That's exactly how the games work.
And yeah. Do you have people doing that? Do you have people show up and say, you know, I'm Jenny, and I'm here to do RevQuest number 3?
We absolutely do, but you don't... you don't have to experience the pre-visit online mm-hmm. in order to play the game once you arrive. It's designed ideally to work that way, but it is possible for people to show up. And at this point in time, most people who play the game have not had the opportunity to do the pre-visit mm-hmm. online. But it's precisely how you imagined it. You are introduced to the game. Through the course of each game, you go to different places in the Revolutionary City, in the historic area. You have to you follow a series of clues, you meet a series of characters, and you follow this story in which you are the hero.
That's always great.
Because that, if you remember, I said that the umbrella name is RevQuest Save the Revolution. Mm-hmm. And in each one of the games, you are invited to help save the revolution. That's your role in the game.
But Bill, there's a problem. What happens when a little British kid shows up? They're the bad guys.
I've actually experienced a lot of them transforming instantly into American patriot kids for the purpose of the uh-huh. game. I have to share an anecdote related to that.
Please.
I used to portray Patrick Henry. Mm-hmm. For a number of years before we brought Richard Schumann in to be a full-time Patrick
Henry. I saw you once, and you did a great job.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Well, one day I was doing a presentation at the Capitol in a program that we call Prelude to Independence, and it's about Virginia's resolution for independence that was then sent to Philadelphia and prodded the Congress to move to a Declaration of Independence. And I give this typical sort of fire-breathing Patrick Henry speech that addresses our resolution for independence, and from this day forward, Virginians will not bear the yoke of tyranny and what have you, and this rousing speech. And I'm coming down off the platform at the end of the speech, and I step down. There are some people sort of giving me sideways glances standing at the bottom of the steps. And I get to the bottom of the steps, and I nod to these people, and the gentleman says to me, he says, "You're very proud of that, aren't you?"
Did he call you a traitor?
but he and his wife both laughed, and then I actually broke character, and I engaged them in a conversation, and they were delightful, and they had in a very different sort of way had gotten a big kick out of this whole program.
Oh, that's an absolutely wonderful story. It really and truly is. Now you've played Patrick Henry. You've
yes.
played a carpenter.
Yeah.
What else have you played?
Well, working in the carpentry and working under the approach that Roy Underhill really urged on us, we weren't portraying characters as such as we were just casting ourselves in that historic moment mm-hmm. as a carpenter,
right?
And addressing people as if we were right there in 1776 and we were building this building and what have you. The first character proper that I portrayed was a Baptist preacher named Lewis Craig, mm-hmm. who came from Fredericksburg and was one of a group of Baptist preachers who began to spread the Baptist doctrine and was arrested and thrown in jail a number of times.
Do they put you in the stocks?
There is actual film footage of me in jail.
Before we go on, That's spelled G-A-O-L.
That's right.
I'll tell you what, I spent the first 25 of years of my life mentally pronouncing that as Gaul.
Gaul.
Why do they put people in Gaul, and that's just the old spelling of
Well, and I'll tell you, the most typical misreading is goal. People just reverse the A and the O. Well, why do you go to the goal, you know? And they get the fact that it's a jail, but... just the archaic spelling is a source of interest for
people. It is. But I interrupted you. Of course, Baptists at that time were outcasts.
They were.
They were not part of this, the Anglican hierarchy. Anglicanism was, of course, the official state religion here. And so that's why these people were being jailed, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Bill Weldon, who's the Director of Creative Development for the Revolutionary City, all at Colonial Williamsburg. After the break, we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more with Bill, but then we've got a couple of his colleagues, actually three more of his colleagues, we're going to speak to about all sorts of educational outreach and educational programs at that fascinating place. So stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Bill Weldon, who's the Director of Creative Development at the Revolutionary City at Colonial Williamsburg. Now, Bill obviously has all kinds of historical knowledge, and he and I were having a fascinating discussion before the break about religious dissenters in Virginia. Did you know there was an official state religion in Virginia? If you happen to be an Episcopalian, you were in pretty good shape, but if you were others, especially if you were a Baptist, you weren't. In fact, you might end up in a place called jail with an odd spelling, G-A-O-L, which has caused more than one person, including me, a little bit of confusion. Now let's return to our discussion with Bill Weldon.
Several of what were known as dissenting sects or dissenting denominations, Presbyterians, Quakers, Baptists, were really practicing their faith in defiance of the government and of official English and British policy. That's right. But with the declaring of independence and with the separation from Britain, there was almost a de facto acceptance of these dissenting groups. As a matter of fact, once we declared independence, Methodists and Baptists, well, Methodists were actually still a part of the Anglican Church at that point in time, but Presbyterian and Baptists were actually allowed in as chaplains in the American Army.
The way I've always heard it explained was that Washington basically needed to cobble together an army from different regions and different religious traditions, and the last thing he needed was intolerance in the ranks. And so he was a very tolerant commander, and that was maybe the genesis of a lot of American religious tolerance in our founding era, was that, Washington had to have Presbyterians fighting alongside Baptists. Not too many Quakers, but Anglicans fighting all next to each other on the same side.
Well, you know, interestingly, the Presbyterians gained acceptance even with the Anglicans and with the establishment earlier on. And even in the French and Indian War, 1750s, some of the Presbyterian preachers were some of the best recruiters for the militias in the backcountry, for the British at that point in time. The Baptists weren't as willing to play by the rules as Presbyterians had been. So they continued to be a thorn in the side of the Anglicans all the way up to and into the War for Independence.
I see. Well, you've also played other people. You've played Thaddeus Stevens, I know, because you and I did an EFT together on that.
Well, and the in the Electronic Field Trip series, I've had the opportunity to play probably 8 or 9 different historic characters. And I've just loved and relished every opportunity to do that. I have a couple of programs coming up here in the next couple of weeks where I'll be portraying characters. Mm-hmm. We have a presentation that we call Wolf by the Ear, Thomas Jefferson and the Pursuit of Freedom, mm-hmm. which is really a play that we have put together in which Jefferson is at home at Monticello in 1820, awaiting news of the vote on whether or not Missouri will be admitted to the Union as a free state or a slave state. And Jefferson is very hopeful that Missouri will come in as a free state, so that hopefully that will sort of further drive a nail in the coffin of the institution of slavery, that hopefully will take a substantial step toward ending slavery. But as he thinks about this vote on Missouri, the first Missouri Compromise is what it amounted to, he thinks back to the period of the Revolution. And then he recalls all these points in history from the Revolution moving up to that moment in 1820, where the issue of slavery was debated and where something could have been done to sort of further the cause of abolition and ending slavery. And so he has a series of recollections in which a number of characters appear. Mm-hmm. Patrick Henry and Edmund Randolph debating Virginia's ratification of the federal constitution. The Haitian revolutionary Jean-Jacques Dessalines. And then finally, in the next to last scene, Henry Clay appears, and I portray Henry Clay in the Wolf by the Ear.
You're a jack
production.
Of all trades.
Well, I've been just very fortunate to have the opportunity to portray a number of these characters. But as Henry Clay, I'm afraid I have to come in and make a speech that then results in bursting Jefferson's bubble.
Ouch.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a tough issue, and I'm so glad to hear you mention it. Slavery is something that, you know, for so long was ignored or suppressed, and Williamsburg and many other historic sites are now facing it much more squarely. But one thing that's always struck me about that is that to truly portray slavery, you would literally have to get African Americans to interpret the characters, and in some very, very tough situations, people in chains, people being beaten, in some cases mistreated. I mean, that's not all of the slavery experience, but it would have to be, you know, people portraying slaves. I haven't visited the Revolutionary City recently. Mm-hmm. I don't know, do you go that far? Is that too sensitive a subject? Is it too painful a subject? How does a historic site like Williamsburg deal with such an unpleasant memory?
It's probably the greatest challenge that we face in telling the story. Mm-hmm. But we're very aware of the fact that we have to portray and convey that sense of the brutality, of the dehumanization, because that's the essence of what slavery was. And we have to characterize it in a way that will cause guests to empathize with those characters and to certainly empathize with the whole essence of the story. But one of our most recent efforts to portray exactly what you're speaking to now is a scene that's called What Holds the Future, in which a group of the last British royal governor's slaves are preparing to be auctioned to buy the Patriot government. by the by the provisional government. And in that scene, we actually portray a family being separated. We portray a man having been whipped, and he actually appears in the scene in manacles. He appears handcuffed in the scene, and we reveal the fact that he's been beaten a number of times and whipped a number of times in that scene. Most times at the conclusion of that scene, the audience just sits, and there's this profound silence for 30 seconds, a minute sometimes. Sometimes the cast will come back out of character, and because we've discovered that the audiences appreciate the opportunity to deconstruct that experience and to talk about why it's important to portray and the challenges of portraying it.
I would think one challenge is just finding African-American actors who would be willing to do it. I mean, that's got to be such a hard thing to do.
We have had a number of African-American actors, incredibly talented people, tell us that they were just not willing to portray a slave.
I understand. Well, I sympathize. I understand. I sympathize.
I do too. And when we audition and interview African-American actors for these roles, we are very clear with them about how difficult it will be, it can be, it is. And we encourage them to have conversations with some of the other actors who portray enslaved people, because we want them to fully understand and appreciate what they're going to be involved in. And I will say that for those who pursue it and who undertake those roles, while they have many days that are very difficult for them, overall they do it and they continue to do it because they absolutely believe in how critical it is to communicate that story and to thereby honor those people and give voice to those people who were absolutely voiceless and who have been voiceless in so much of our history too.
Yeah, it would, I think. There are analogies to other circumstances. You can think of a Jewish actor being asked to portray a Holocaust victim.
Yes.
That's an important portrayal, too. It's important for our understanding of it, but must be very personally painful for that actor to do so. And again, I applaud you so very much for doing this, because I have not seen this presentation, but I'm going to make a point of doing it at some point.
Please do. When you have an opportunity.
It's a very poignant
thing. Yeah, when you have an opportunity, that's one scene that we really encourage people to try to find, to experience.
So as creative director, you're in charge of all of this. You're the guy that says, I think we need a sequence on this, or I think we need a play on that, or we need to do this.
Well, it's a process of working with our historians to identify the stories that are legitimately part of Williamsburg's history or have a relationship to Williamsburg's history. And then to work with the actors and the site interpreters and all the people in other interpretive roles. So it's really a team effort to bring these kinds of programs to fruition. The thing that we take very seriously is that we're presenting good history, and that we are not, while we do certainly take some dramatic license, and we have to pursue the stories, that we are not misrepresenting anything, and we are not sensationalizing anything, that what we're portraying and the way that we're portraying it is historically responsible. That's what it's a matter of. That's what it's a matter of trying to accomplish.
Well, I'm going to pitch an idea to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think you should do one where a modern day middle-aged, short bearded law professor goes back in time and has all kinds of adventures. And I know somebody who could portray it for you.
My goodness.
Isn't that a great idea?
I think it's a tremendous idea.
Well, we'll talk. I'll have my agent call you.
I'm not joking. I think there is some real potential for pursuing.
Stay tuned, folks, and we'll let you know when that production launches. Well, Bill, thank you very, very much for
my
your time.
My pleasure.
This has been illuminating and entertaining, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just had a fascinating discussion with Bill Weldon, the Director of Creative Development at the Revolutionary City at Colonial Williamsburg. After the break, I'm going to speak to a couple of Bill's colleagues. Their names are Francis Burrows and Lisa Huvel, so stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm about to speak with Francis Burrows, the Director of Educational Program Development at Colonial Williamsburg, and her colleague Lisa Huvel, the Manager of Education Media. They're going to tell me all about electronic field trips, distance learning, education outreach, the Teacher Institute, you name it. We're going to talk about it.
I'm Francis Burrows, and I am the Teresa A. and Lawrence C. Salamino Director of Educational Program Development for Productions, Publications, and Learning Ventures.
That is the longest, most impressive-sounding title I've heard in a long, long time.
You should see my business card.
I see. It's tremendous. And Lisa, to tell us who you are.
Stuart, I'm Lisa Huvel, and I'm the Manager of Program Development Initiatives for Colonial Williamsburg Education Outreach.
That's almost equally long and impressive as well. Tremendous. Well, what does this mean? What do you do?
Well, to start with me, that means that I work primarily on the major education initiatives that Colonial Williamsburg Education Outreach is involved in. So I'm working on the electronic field trips, both the current season and our next generation of electronic field trips. I'm working on distance learning. And besides that, pretty much anything else that comes along.
Well, you got me hooked there with this. What's this next generation of electronic field trips? What does that involve?
What we're looking at is a total shifting of how we have done the electronic field trips. It's been an excellent model ever since the first beginnings of the experimental programs in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
But times change, education changes, and most of all, our students change. And what we're doing now is responding to the challenges that teachers have in the classroom, particularly of making history relevant to a whole new generation of, we hope, will be history lovers.
Okay, can you give us a hint as to what this new, are we talking technological changes? Or are we talking simply an approach in what you present or the topics that you present? What exactly is this going to mean?
We've always been forerunners in terms of presenting history education in a relevant way. Mm-hmm. In the past, as you might imagine, it was concentrated on the colonial aspects of history, on the founding fathers, on everything that's made America great. But we also recognize that teachers have to move beyond that during the school year. And so what we've started to look at very seriously and have evolved into is presenting into the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Lisa, because when I was here helping out in an EFT, it was last November, and it was on separation of powers, and I was a little bit surprised when I looked up to see Franklin Roosevelt sitting there. Wait a second, it's Colonial Williamsburg. I wanted muskets and wigs. I didn't want to see Franklin Roosevelt, and then all of a sudden I realized, well, you all are just bringing it forward now, aren't you?
We are, and it's our obligation to do that, because to stay focused on the past, while it's a wonderful past and a true heritage does not help us to bring history alive for students, and that's a key part of the Colonial Williamsburg mission, and I'm sure Francis can tell you a lot more about that.
Francis, you're on.
Well, we have a mandate to, through our mission, bring the past to the present, and in any program we can do where we use history as a base and can make it relevant for students and teachers, because I actually work a great deal with teacher professional development. I oversee that group and the one Lisa's with, which is primarily educational media related programs that are for classroom use, homeschool use. The idea that we're a center in concept, a center for history and citizenship, is probably one of the best ways to express what we're trying to do, where history and the stories, the innate interesting stories of history that can bring to life the past for people today who are going through some of the same struggles, the same issues, are seeing things around them and being confused by them, can then be told stories that basically make them understand that a lot of these are not new stories. We are able, from our revolutionary city, the switch from basically a colonial focus to a revolutionary spirit and movement toward that in our interactions with guests who come here, to programming on site from organizations that are talking about democracy in foreign countries, or a Chautauqua type program, or emerging leaders with the University of Virginia's Sorenson Institute.
Oh, wonderful place, Sorenson. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I've got one kid who's at UVA right now, and he was previously involved in Sorenson. And it seems every time I'm at a historic site like this, whether it's Montpelier, Colonial Williamsburg, you turn around and somebody, it's like they've got a secret club, the Sorenson people, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, it is. But it's a good club. It's a good club.
I think I'd like to add that the teacher professional development programming here has another kind of reach. We are in our 25th year of hosting teachers on a week-long program, which used to be called the Summer Teacher Institute, which has morphed into a year-long series of weeks where teachers come on site. They learn about the techniques of using history in the classroom and the methods of what we call historical interpretation to reenact, to explore, to feel, see, and touch things of the past, and use them in their classroom in a very sensory way. The reach of the program is national. There have been over 7,000 teachers through it in 25 years, and we figure if you multiply a teacher's tenure in the classroom of 20 years times the number of students they get each year, that the reach of the program is quite phenomenal.
It's quite a leverage point. You've mentioned social media, you've mentioned the internet, so what's the internet address? What's the website?
Our Facebook page is Colonial Williamsburg for Teachers.
Okay. And your website is?
History.org/teach.
I've heard of that. History.org. I don't know if a lot of people realize that History.org, which is so well known, is specifically associated with Colonial Williamsburg. Now, that's not a criticism, but I was aware, of course, of Colonial Williamsburg, and I was aware of History.org. I've used it as a resource on many occasions. I don't think I ever put the two of them together.
And that is probably one of our problems. We also have, though, colonialwilliamsburg.com, and that will also get you to us.
So I guess you have a Twitter handle, too, right?
We do, and it's EFT_CW.
Okay, EFT_CW, and that's for your electronic field trips especially.
Exactly, and honestly, Stuart, there are so many new changes and innovations going on with history.org that it's well worth going onto that site. That's a way to catch up with what we're doing now as well. And we hope that your listeners will look forward to our next generation of electronic field trips online, because we're developing a media library that's going to bring to bear all of our resources.
Tremendous. Well, ladies, thank you so very, very much for your time, Lisa and Francis both. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with several of the people at Colonial Williamsburg who make the magic happen, who often work behind the scenes and design and implement these wonderful educational programs that we all enjoy there, either on-site or, as we've just seen, electronically, all over the Internet, all over the world. I've saved the boss for last. His name is Bill White. And everybody at Williamsburg seems to be named Bill. Have you noticed that? Yeah. We talked to Bill Weldon earlier, but now we're going to talk to Bill White. And it turns out that Bill White has a remarkable career trajectory, which has put him in charge of pretty much everything we've been talking about today.
Well, my name is Bill White, and I am the Royce R. and Catherine M. Baker Vice President for Productions, Publications, and Learning Ventures, which is a long-winded way of saying that I'm responsible for Colonial Williamsburg's Education Outreach Initiative.
And that is a big job.
Well, it includes things like our teacher development programming, the Teacher Institute. We go off-site to work with teachers around the country. It includes curriculum programs like the National Electronic Field Trip broadcast we do once a month to elementary and middle school classrooms. It includes things like the Idea of America, a high school curriculum program, the education website, history.org. We do audio and video, book publishing. So it's a really interesting collection of fun things.
You are the Rupert Murdoch of Colonial Williamsburg. You have a media empire that you oversee.
It may be a small empire, but it certainly is the. I have worked at Colonial Williamsburg my entire career.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you how one gets to do this. Give us the brief biographical sketch.
Well, I'm not sure if mine is a typical story though.
So that's all right.
And
you came here straight out of school.
No, actually in 1965, I was a fifth grader in town, and I wandered down to what's known as the Travis House. It was then the headquarters for the Fife and Drum Corps, and wandered in and asked if there were any openings in the Fife and Drum Corps. And the director at the time, a man named George Carroll, said, "Well, you'll have to be a fifer because I have too many drummers." And I said, "Okay."
And did you play a fife?
I played a fife.
Did you already know in fifth grade?
No.
So you just showed up and said,
from scratch.
Okay.
From 1965 to 1971, I was one of the members of the Fife and Drum Corps. In 1971, I graduated.
Saw you.
You probably did.
I was here in that time, and I probably saw you marching right down the street.
You probably did. In 1971, I took a job on staff working with the Fife and Drum Corps and worked there until 1985, I took my first administrative job, and I was the director of the performing arts group here at Colonial Williamsburg. It's called the Company of Colonial Performers. I took care of all the school children who came on site for a while. I was responsible for all the special event programming for a while. Took care of all the evening programs for a while. I was the director of the Historic Trades Department for a while. So I worked in the historic area until 1998, and then moved over here because Richard McClooney, who was then responsible for the productions area, was starting up the new electronic field trip series, a new outreach to schools and school children. And it looked like a whole lot of fun. And
cool. So let me just to summarize then. Williamsburg, when I first experienced it in the late 60s and when you first started working here, was primarily an on-site experience. Okay,
it wasn't.
Oh, okay, well then, please.
Well, from the 1950s, Colonial Williamsburg had a film production unit.
They had like an orientation film.
But you may also remember in grade school seeing 9mm films and film strips from Colonial Williamsburg.
I think I did.
And they were all produced here at Colonial Williamsburg. They were produced for the school audience, for the classroom audience.
For our younger...
And there was actually a fairly big operation that, right. that sent those films out around the country and then, you know, received them back and shipped them out to the next person who had them reserved.
For the under 40 crowd,
yep.
a film strip was a series of pictures. Basically, they were a series of slides
right.
that were in one long strip with a little, what am I thinking of? They were, you pulled them through a machine one
That's
by
right.
one, and then you either had a tape recorder, which played along with it.
Oh, and before that, a record.
Or a record, or you simply had some student who would have to read from a script as
right.
he clicked through them. And I did that on more than one occasion when I was in school. So, okay, probably did come across those materials. So outreach far predates the digital era.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But you were mostly on site.
I was mostly on site until 1998, 1999,
mm-hmm.
and then moved over and began to work with the outreach program. And the digital era has just changed that completely. I mean, it's changed what museums are able to do. So museums are no longer bound by those physical boundaries. We now can reach outside of those boundaries. We can reach out to engage and have a substantial interaction with people who are no longer on site. We have video, we have interactive portions, we have blogs, we have comment sections, it's an opportunity for people to engage with the institution in really substantial ways using digital media.
And I know this from personal experience. A few months ago, I was out here for your electronic field trip on separation of powers.
Right.
And you assigned me to be a telephone question helper. And you had a bank of people sitting at telephones. And so as the electronic field trip was being broadcast
right.
to schoolrooms all across the country, if a schoolroom had a question, they could call in, and if the volunteer could handle it, fine. And if the volunteer wasn't quite comfortable with it, and it had typically had something to do with constitutional law they weren't familiar with, then they'd come over to somebody like me or somebody like Bill Sullivan, one of your historians here, and they'd ask us, and we would give them our best answer on the spot, and then it would go straight back out over the telephone lines in real time. So it was highly, highly interactive.
Well, and some of those questions from kids were answered live on the television
right,
screen.
On the television screen.
So,
exactly, but you couldn't do them all live. Honestly.
Can't do them all live,
right.
And so those roll over to those phone rooms in the back. The extra right. rolls over to those phone rooms in the back because, you know, like a real field trip to a museum, you want for kids to have the opportunity to ask those questions and find an answer, no matter what the question is, because that's what's magical about a museum. It's the interaction. It's a relationship that's set up between the institution and the individual. And with kids, that's what creates the excitement that makes learning fun.
It does. And some of the questions are truly unpredictable. We were doing this on separation of powers in the Constitution, and one question was, how big is the White House?
We
did our best job on that one.
You know, those questions, you know, with particularly with elementary school
yes.
the kids, you know, the how big, the how many, you know, the quantify questions are important. But I'll never remember, I mean, years ago, for one of the early field trips, we had Ron Hoffman, who's a really great early American historian. He was here on screen to answer kids' questions. He was the director of the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture there at William & Mary. And he got up after the first program and looked at everybody and said, wow, they ask really hard questions, don't they?
They do.
Because they do. You know, kids are inquisitive, and when you give them some background and when you give them powerful stories that American history provides, then they ask really tough questions, and they're really engaged. And for me, that's always the excitement of history. Are those questions. You know, too many people figure that it's all about the names, the dates, the places, and being able to remember and recite those things, but it really isn't. It's the how and the what and the why kinds of questions that make history important to us and who we are today.
Right. The facts are just the framework.
That's right.
And the understanding happens only later. with those better questions. With something else you mentioned I'd appreciate you telling me about is your on-site training for teachers or your curriculum development. I mean, do you actually help public school and private school teachers to develop these things? How does that work?
Well, absolutely. So this will be the 2014 will be the 25th anniversary of the Teacher Institute. And we're bringing about 500 teachers to Colonial Williamsburg every summer for a week-long experience in groups of about 25, a week-long experience in the museum. Most of them are elementary school teachers, and for those elementary school teachers, you know, many of them don't have a strong background in history or in social studies, teaching that part of the curriculum. And here at Williamsburg, they can dive in and they can learn about primary sources and documents and how they're used. They can learn that artifacts are primary sources too, and that history is something tactile that you can walk in and touch. They learn how to use an institution, a museum like Colonial Williamsburg, so they can return to their community and find the local history institutions in their community and use those as well. They learn that a little bit of drama in the classroom really helps to make history exciting and engaging. So they meet our character interpreters and first-person interpreters at Colonial Williamsburg, and they learn something about what they do and how they make history exciting.
So it's not just content, it's actually presentation
as well. It's presentation. Presentation's critically important.
Yes, it is.
Because you know, as we were saying a minute ago, if history is just the names, the dates, the places, the facts, then it becomes tough really quickly. And if that's what our kids think American history is, then it's hard to get them excited about it. And if they're not excited about American history, then there's no hope that they're going to learn what responsible citizens do in the Republic. There's no place that tells those stories of responsible citizenship except our history.
If they're not listening, they're not learning.
That's right.
You've got to engage them. In fact, some years ago, I was really surprised and rather dispirited when I read in a fairly reputable source that the least popular high school class was not, as I thought, math or science. It was history.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, how could that be? And then the explanation that was provided was that it had gotten so bland, so dumbed down, so fact and date specific that people just zoned out after about a minute, and then that was it. It was an endurance for them, for the students.
Right.
How terrible. Our history is dramatic. It's full of rogues and scoundrels and good guys and bad guys and people with all sorts of mixes of motives and all the human failings that we all have, and that makes for great drama if you tell it right.
If you tell it right. Or if you let, what's even better, if you let kids discover it, which is another big part of what I think the institution does really well with teachers is to help them find the ways for kids to discover.
Well, history. I'm sure we've whetted the appetite of more than one teacher. How does he or she get involved in this?
The easiest way is to come to the education website, which is history.org, and to click on the education section, and you'll find information there about the Teacher Institute, about our curriculum programs, about the electronic field trip, about all the things that Colonial Williamsburg has to offer here on site and in the virtual world as well.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to our good friends at Colonial Williamsburg. And remember, next week we have our third and final episode in this series, which is really a humdinger. Thanks very much to Bill Weldon. And thanks, of course, to Francis Burrows and Lisa Huvel. And, of course, to Bill White, with whom we just spoke. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part, an important part, of the American experiment.